Catra Podcast Conversations for the Curious Essential Knowledge, Simplified, your gateway to essential ideas that matter most. This audio summary has been prepared with the help of a Catra AI. Welcome back to the Deep Dive. Today we're tackling a really foundational topic, something that, well, shapes almost everything in global affairs.
We're talking about international law.
Exactly. And it's a subject that often gets a, let's say, cynical reaction.
Oh, definitely. People immediately ask, you know, is it really law? Because there's no global government, no world police to enforce it.
That's the big hurdle, isn't it? So today we're diving into Von Lowe's brilliant little book, International Law, a very short introduction. Our mission is to unpack its essential ideas, because honestly, you need them to make sense of world events.
And Lowe's book directly confronts that cynicism. He argues right from the start that if you look at international law, expecting it to work like, say, UK domestic law.
With courts and police and prisons.
You're going to completely miss the point. It's a fundamentally different kind of system. It's horizontal, not vertical.
Understanding that difference is so critical right now for you listening. Think about it. Trade wars, climate negotiations, armed conflicts.
Yeah, all of it. International law provides the analytical lens. Without it, global politics can just look like a chaotic power struggle.
This framework gives us the rules of the road, essentially. It structures how states interact, how they justify their actions, how they cooperate or don't.
Even when the rules are broken, the framework itself is still the point of reference.
Okay, so let's talk about our guide through this complex world, Sir Von Lowe. What makes his perspective so valuable?
Well, Lowe is kind of the ideal guide here. He's got this really unique combination of experience.
He's not just an academic.
He's a top-tier academic, yes. Mm. Held the Cecil Professorship of Public International Law at Oxford. I mean, that's about as prestigious as it gets in this field.
Right.
But, and this is crucial, he didn't just stay in the ivory tower. He's also a practicing barrister, a King's Counsel.
Ah, so he's argued cases.
Over 90 of them. Before the International Court of Justice, the ICJ, representing actual countries in major disputes.
Wow. Okay, so he's seen it from both sides, the theory and the, well, the messy reality.
Exactly. He understands the high-level debates, but he also knows how government lawyers and diplomats actually use the law in high-stakes situations. You know, boundary disputes, use of force cases, the really tough stuff.
So his insights aren't just theoretical, they're grounded, pragmatic.
Totally. He gets what the law can realistically achieve in a world of sovereign states and, importantly, what it can't.
That practical viewpoint must really shape the book's core argument then. If international law isn't orders from a world government, what is it according to Lowe?
Okay, so this is the central idea, and it's quite a powerful reframing. Lowe argues that international law is fundamentally a sophisticated system of argument and process.
A system of argument, not just rules.
Well, the rules are part of it. But its essence is the dialogue. It provides the shared language, the grammar, for international relations and diplomacy. It's less about command, more about conversation and justification.
So its main job isn't necessarily to stop power politics.
No, it can't eliminate power, but it manages it. It channels it. It provides the framework, the arena, where states can test their interests and justify their actions.
Its real power then lies in conferring legitimacy. Or denying it.
Precisely. Think about it. Whenever a state acts on the world stage, especially if it's controversial, what's the first thing it does?
It puts out a legal justification.
Always. Even if the justification seems thin to others. That act of arguing, of making a legal claim, and the counterarguments that follow that, Lowe says, is the practice of international law in action.
That flips the common question, doesn't it? Instead of asking, why isn't it enforced?
Yeah.
We should ask, why do powerful states even bother making legal arguments?
And the answer is that legitimacy matters. Being seen as acting lawfully, or at least arguably lawfully, is crucial for building coalitions, for maintaining diplomatic relations, for trade. Being branded an outlaw has real costs.
Okay, so the book aims to give us a realistic picture of how this system, built on consent and argument, actually works.
Right, moving away from the myths and towards the operational reality.
So let's dig into that reality. How is this law actually made and maintained if it's horizontal among equals?
Okay, first, we have to keep that core difference in mind. Domestic law is vertical laws handed down. International law is horizontal laws emerging between sovereign states.
And because they're sovereign equals, the ultimate basis has to be their agreement, their consent.
Exactly. States aren't automatically bound. They agree to be bound by the rules, whether explicitly or implicitly.
Which brings us back to that nagging question. Why comply? If consent can be given, can it be withdrawn? Why follow the rules without a global police force?
Lo gives two main reasons, and they're quite practical. First, reciprocity. It's the golden rule, basically.
Mm.
If I want my borders respected, my diplomats treated properly, my ships to sail freely, then I need to respect yours.
Tit for tat.
Essentially, yes. And second, the reputational cost. Being seen as a state that breaks its word, that flouts international norms, well, it damages your standing. It makes other states wary of dealing with you. It can impact trade, investment, alliances.
So self-interest and mutual interest play a huge role in compliance.
A much bigger role than most people realize.
All right.
Okay, so if that's the why, what about the what? Where do the actual rules come from?
The sources of international law.
Right. The go-to list is Article 38 of the Statute of the International Court of Justice. First and most obvious, treaties.
Written agreements, like contracts between states.
They can be. Bilateral investment treaties, trade deals. Or they could be huge multilateral agreements like the UN Charter or the Geneva Conventions, which function almost like legislation for the international community.
Yeah.
Signed, ratified, very formal.
Okay, treaties are clear enough, but the second source is where it gets a bit more nebulous. Customary International Law, or CIL.
Ah, yes. The unwritten law. This one definitely confuses people. How do you know an unwritten rule exists and is binding?
Yeah.
It needs two ingredients. You have to prove both. First, consistent state practice. You need to show that states generally and consistently behave in a certain way over time.
Like respecting diplomatic immunity, for instance.
That's a classic example. But practice alone isn't enough. It could just be courtesy or habit. You also need the second crucial element, the belief that this practice is legally required. Lawyers call this opinio juris.
Opinio juris.
Yeah.
So states do it not just because it's convenient or polite, but because they feel legally obligated to do it.
Exactly that. That belief transforms mere usage into binding custom. Think about the rules for sailing on the high seas for centuries. States followed certain rules out of a sense of legal obligation long before they were written down in treaties. That's CIL.
Okay, so treaties and custom are the main ways laws are made. But are there some rules that are sort of non-negotiable? Absolutely.
Yeah, yes. That's where jus cogens comes in. These are peremptory norms. Think of them as the fundamental overriding principles of international law.
Like bedrock principles.
Absolutely. Things of the prohibition of genocide, slavery, torture, wars of aggression. These norms are considered so fundamental to the international community that no state can opt out of them.
So a treaty that aimed to permit genocide would just be void.
Instantly void. Jus cogens trumps treaty law and customary law. It represents a kind of global public order, basic values the system won't compromise on.
Okay, that makes sense. Now, moving from how law is made to how it's applied, let's touch on jurisdiction. How far does a state's legal authority reach?
Well, the basics are territory, and nationality states generally have jurisdiction over acts on their territory and over their nationals abroad. But the really interesting and sometimes controversial principle is universality.
Universality, meaning universal reach.
For certain exceptionally serious crimes, yes. We're talking about core international crimes. Genocide, war crimes, crimes against humanity, sometimes torture. The principle holds that any state can prosecute these crimes, regardless of where they happened or the nationality of the perpetrator or victim.
Any state? Why?
Because these crimes are seen as offenses against the entire international community, against fundamental human values. So any state has an interest and potentially a right or duty to bring perpetrators to justice.
And the case that really brought this principle into the spotlight was the Pinochet case.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah.
The arrest of former Chilean dictator Augusto Pinochet in London in 1998, based on a Spanish warrant. That was a watershed moment.
He was arrested in the UK for crimes committed in Chile against Chileans.
Exactly. Years after he left power, it sent shockwaves. It dramatically showed that the old shields of sovereign immunity and acting head of state immunity weren't absolute, especially when facing charges like widespread torture.
It really punched a hole in the idea that leaders were untouchable once they left office.
It did. It was a huge boost for international criminal justice and the idea that law could reach individuals, not just states.
Which leads us to perhaps the most critical area, the rules on the use of force.
The heart of the matter, really. The UN Charter, drafted after World War II, has a cornerstone principle, Article 2.4.
Which is?
The general prohibition on the threat or use of force against the territorial integrity or political independence of any state. Basically, aggressive war is outlawed.
A fundamental shift from earlier eras.
A massive shift. And the Charter allows only two clear exceptions to this ban.
Okay, what are they?
First, the inherent right of individual or collective self-defense if an armed attack occurs. That's Article 51. It has to be necessary and proportionate, a response to an actual attack.
And the second?
Force authorized by the UN Security Council under Chapter 7 of the Charter, specifically to maintain or restore international peace and security.
So self-defense or a Security Council resolution, that's it.
Those are the only two explicitly written in the Charter. But as you know, life gets complicated. What about massive humanitarian crises? Genocides happening where the Security Council is deadlocked, maybe by a veto.
Right. Rwanda, Srebrenica.
Yeah.
Those haunt the international community.
Exactly. Which led to the development, or attempted development, of the doctrine called the Responsibility to Protect, or R2P.
R2P. I've heard of it, but it sounds controversial.
It is highly controversial. Because it bumps right up against state sovereignty. The idea is that sovereignty isn't just a right. It entails a responsibility for the state to protect its own population from mass atrocities.
And if the state fails, or is the perpetrator.
Then R2P suggests the responsibility shifts to the international community, potentially including intervention, maybe even military intervention as a last resort, though that part is the most contested.
So it's the law trying to adapt to horrific situations, grappling with that tension between respecting sovereignty and protecting human life.
Precisely. It shows how international law isn't static. It's constantly debated, evolving, especially around these incredibly difficult moral and political questions.
Okay, stepping back from the specific rules, let's crystallize the main messages Lowe wants us to take away. What are the big themes?
I think the first, and we've hit this a few times, is law as process and argument. Don't just look for enforcement. Look at how states use legal language to justify, persuade, and legitimize their actions. That is the system working.
Its power is in framing the debate.
Yes. Second big theme, the sovereignty versus obligation paradox. The whole system is built on respecting state sovereignty. They have to consent. But once they consent through treaties or custom, those obligations become binding. It's a voluntary entry into a binding framework.
That tension is always there.
Always. And the third theme is the shift from coexistence to cooperation. Historically, international law was mostly about live and let live, setting boundaries, diplomatic rules, keep states apart peacefully. Now, with globalization, climate change, pandemics, cyber threats, the biggest challenges require active cooperation. International law is increasingly the essential tool for facilitating that cooperation, for creating regimes to manage shared problems no single state can solve.
That's a really important shift in purpose.
Yeah, Philly.
Lowe also has a knack for sharp, memorable ways of putting things. Let's share a few key ideas, sort of paraphrased quotes.
Yeah, he does. One I really like is, international law is the indispensable grammar of international relations.
The grammar, I like that. It's not necessarily the substance of every conversation, but it provides the structure, the rules that make coherent interaction possible. Without grammar, it's just noise.
Exactly. Another crucial one, especially for tackling cynicism, is this. Compliance is the norm. Violation is the exception, like a car crash on a highway where millions of journeys are completed safely without notice.
That's such a great analogy. We focus on the crashes, the wars, the treaty violations because they make headlines. But we ignore the millions of successful journeys, daily planes flowing under agreed rules, mail crossing borders, trade flowing based on WTO agreements.
The vast, silent majority of international law works pretty well, day in, day out.
Okay, one more. What about power? Does law just yield to power?
Lowe has a nuanced take. Law does not eliminate power. It acts as the arena in which power struggles are fought, offering tools for the weak to challenge the strong.
So it channels the struggle, gives weaker states a platform.
Yes. It forces even the most powerful states to justify their actions in legal terms. This open space for counterarguments, for diplomacy, for mobilizing international opinion. It provides the weak with the weapons of legal argument, which can be surprisingly effective.
It levels the playing field somewhat.
Or at least provides the rules for the game being played on that field.
So thinking practically for our listeners, how can they use these insights from Lowe's book day to day?
Well, the most obvious application is decoding international news. When you hear about a dispute, say, sanctions on a country or a clash over maritime territory.
Like in the South China Sea, for example.
Right. Instead of just seeing power politics, you can now ask the legal questions. What specific treaty is being invoked? Is this a claim based on customary law? Which state is claiming self-defense, and does it meet the criteria? Which court or tribunal might have jurisdiction?
It adds a whole new layer of understanding beyond just who has more ships.
Absolutely. It helps you critically evaluate the justifications states offer for their actions.
And that leads to the second application, which is about informed citizenship, right?
Exactly. Understanding these principles allows you to better assess your own government's foreign policy. Are its actions consistent with the international legal obligations it has signed up to?
Whether it's climate treaties, human rights conventions, rules on drone strikes.
You can ask, are we acting in line with the rules we expect others to follow? It fosters accountability.
Okay. As we wrap up, what was the single most surprising or insightful thing you took away from revisiting Lowe's perspective?
For me, it goes back to the very beginning, really internalizing that the system's apparent weakness, the lack of a central enforcer, isn't necessarily a flaw. It's almost a design feature for a world of sovereign equals.
How so?
Because it means the system has to work through persuasion, reciprocity, shared interests, reputational costs, and maybe, just maybe, that creates a more resilient, adaptable, and ultimately stable order than one based purely on top-down coercion could ever be. It forces cooperation rather than commanding it.
That's a really interesting thought. The weakness is the strength. What about you?
I think for me, the most profound takeaway is the evolution Lowe charts, what you call the humanization of international law. It started purely as law between states, sovereigns talking to sovereigns.
Right. Individuals didn't really feature.
But now, with the rise of human rights law, international criminal law, the law is increasingly piercing that veil of sovereignty. It's granting rights directly to individuals and imposing responsibilities on individuals, even leaders. That shift from a purely state-centric system to one that recognizes the individual, that's maybe the biggest story in international law over the past 70 years.
A slow revolution, perhaps.
Perhaps. Yeah. Still unfolding.
See you next time with another remarkable thinker, another powerful book, and another idea that has shaped our world. This audio summary is brought to you by Ekatra Foundation.